Greetings, I'm your host Jason Miles, and welcome to another episode of This is Revolution Podcast. So glad to have you guys with us here live, and of course happy to have the people that will be checking this out later on YouTube and all the other audio only formats. Before we start, if you're new to the channel, please hit like, hit subscribe, and don't forget to hit that notification bell so you're alerted whenever we go live. We're constantly adding new shows and doing cross streams with other channels. Earlier this week, we had a return of the Red Zone. We discussed what's going on in the world of mergers and acquisitions, disguising itself as college football. Yesterday, I spoke with film professor and Hollywood movie editor, Matthew Film Guy, about the tyranny of the blockbuster and what's going on with the future of filmmaking in Hollywood. Those are all up for your viewing and listening pleasure. Please check them out and share them with your friends. As always, thank you to the subscribers on YouTube and Twitch, and of course, all the audio-only formats. You guys are collectively the fuel and the engine that keeps TIR moving. If you're enjoying what we do here and you would like to have access to the champagne room, the call-in segments in the champagne room, be part of the live virtual audience for the Pascal Robert hosted MoMAO Hour, and join us for movie nights, which we're going to be doing this Friday. We'll be watching the mid-90s classic Fear of Black Hat. There's only one way you can do all that, and that is become a patron for as little as $3 a month or $30 for the year. It can all be yours. Tonight, we'll be unveiling a brand new game in the champagne room. I'm so happy to have Doug Lane with us for that. For many of you, your first introduction to TIR was Doug Lane. He was on Zero Books when he would air one of our shows once a week. We used to air our video essays on Zero Books as well. I think they actually have a few of them. So we go back with Doug. He is a big reason for our success, if you will. So we have a lot of respect for Doug Lane. And because of that, I figured who else better to roll out this new game that we'll be playing in the champagne room. It's called Are You a White Ally? We'll ask Doug a series of questions, and you, the viewers, will be the judges. So if he has an answer, it's like, I go to the judges. We'll be going to you guys in the chat. See what you have to say. That'll be tonight in the champagne room. There's only one way to have access to that live. It's become a patron. So before I bring in Doug, let's read the introduction. Recently in the news, three former military officials told Congress that the U.S. government knows quite a bit about alien life. David Grush said that the United States government is in possession of non-human matter and that this is above congressional oversight. What does any of this mean to know that the government could be covering up alien life on Earth? Could we be living in a world like the 1980s TV miniseries V? Is Alex Jones right and the lizard people are real? Or does this speak to our sense of self-importance that all these alien sightings are happening in the U.S.? Or most of them, I shouldn't say all. Recently, Doug Lane did a video essay exploring many of these questions that go much deeper than simply alien life. Please welcome founder of Sublation Media and someone I actually know and call a friend in real life, Douglas Lane.
Hi.
Hey, Doug. How are you?
I'm doing well. Can I hold up a book? I want to hold up my book.
Go ahead.
This is After the Saucers Landed. It's my second novel. And I want to put this out there. This gives me expertise in the subject. I have written a book about UFOs. So I'm glad to talk about it today with you, Jason.
We have a comment already from TIR listener Steve. He says, fuck them bitch-ass aliens.
That's... approach. If you read the literature, there's a lot of stuff going on with asses when it comes to
Well, I recently watched the video essay that you did, and it was excellent. So I have to ask, what motivated you to want to do that? Was it just the congressional hearings, or was it a little bit more?
Well, no, I mean, it was a combination of years of slow dribs and drabs of reporting from the Pentagon and in the mainstream press about the reality of UFOs. And, you know, it culminated in this recent UAP hearing. I hope it actually is not the final word on the story. But when I first heard the whistleblower that everyone who's following this will know the name of, David Grush, interviewed on a News Nation, a cable news channel that I didn't know existed until I saw David Grush be interviewed on that channel. It's like a CNN wannabe, like a knockoff. Looks like the kind of thing you'd see in a movie when they're trying to do CNN without doing CNN. Yeah. But when I heard him get interviewed, I thought, well, this guy is an intelligence officer. He has no documented evidence he's willing to share, but he's been given a go-ahead from the Pentagon to say this much. This is clearly a psyop. But then after I watched the congressional hearing, I wasn't convinced it wasn't a psyop, but I just thought, well, what about the possibility that it isn't? Like, what would it mean if it was what he's saying is true? What would that mean to me as someone who wants to be a socialist? What would it mean? What would it mean overall, for everyone? You know, what would it tell us about the way we're living in society as well? Not just because, you know, what it would mean about the aliens that we supposedly have in bunkers, it's completely a mystery to me. But the story is an interesting one, and it's one that gets told over and over again. It has been since around 1947, after the Roswell incident. Mm-hmm. Also, you know, I was interested in UFOs when I was in my early 20s. Like, I, back when I was a hippie here in the Pacific Northwest, now I'm just a cranky old man, but I used to smoke pot and read Robert Anton Wilson books and read about UFOs. I have another book I could hold up, mm-hmm. which is this one from back then. I bought back then. I don't know if you can read it. The Edge of Reality, mm-hmm. Which is a conversation between J. Allen Hynek and Jacques Vallée. I've had that book for probably coming up on 30 years. Look, there's all sorts of pictures of UFOs in it. Mm-hmm. If you're not convinced now, when will you be convinced? Come on.
I saw it in a pamphlet, so I know it's so.
Yeah, right. But I was fascinated with the idea really since I was a kid, because the idea that we were not alone and that there might be intelligent, more advanced creatures out in the universe was kind of a hopeful thing for me. I mean, I saw Close Encounters when I was pretty young. It came out in 1977. I probably saw it on TV for the first time around 1980 or so, I think. And I just was fascinated by the concept. And I think if anyone takes a step back and tries to think objectively about it, if it is a true story, it will be world historic. It will be a massive, it will indicate a massive change in at least our self-conception. I think so.
In watching the video essay, I'm not going to lie, I was a little upset you didn't have any Starman clips.
Oh, Starman is such a good movie.
Why didn't you have any Starman in there?
Did I don't you forget? Know,
or did no, you try it's not and that, you couldn't?
I only talked really about one film, which was Close Encounters, right? I mean, yeah.
Look, Doug, we both do the same thing. So we have to have all the stock footage.
And yeah, right.
You didn't have any Starman stock footage. Why is that?
Well, Starman is a movie that makes me cry. I couldn't.
So that's what it's really about. You didn't want to get teary eyed with Jeff Bridges.
Jeff Bridges. And when they, you know, it's a love story, and they part ways at the end, and he leaves her with a child. It's just I really like Starman. It's very similar in some ways to Close Encounters. Mm-hmm. I think maybe I'm wrong, but I think one of the actors from Close Encounters is also in Starman. If not, then there's a character who is so close to being, there's a translator in Close Encounters who wanders around the movie, and that same character, and you know what, it's not the same actor, but it's the same character lifted from Close Encounters. And
I was hoping, I was like, Doug's gonna put Starman in here, so I thought you were gonna start it off with Starman, and he didn't. You use some stock footage BS that irritated me, and then I kept watching it, and I was like, either he tried and YouTube pulled it, or he's never seen Starman.
Oh no, I've seen Starman a bunch of times. Yeah, no, it yeah, Jeff Bridges is excellent in that movie. You know, yeah, I'll prove it to you. I've seen it. Like, red means stop.
Who's the
green means Karen Allen, the same woman from I believe from Raiders. Am I right?
You're already winning in the Are You a White Ally game. This is a secret question.
That is that a okay?
No, that is not the really question. This is the whitest question ever. Who was the female lead in Starman? Is not.
I don't know. That, maybe that was very big with the African American demographic. I have no idea. What is John Carpenter loved? Well loved within the Black community?
That's a good question. I don't think he's loved as much as Wes Craven.
Okay. Well, anyway, yes, I would recommend seeing Starman if you haven't seen it. Yeah, anyway, what red means stop, green means go, yellow means go very fast.
You want to hear something even dumber? I went to the movies to see Starman because I thought it was going to be like Star Wars. Boy, was I disappointed.
Yeah.
I mean,
did you like it, though, in the end?
As an older person, as a young person, it made me very angry because there was no space wizards and spaceships and lasers. And those were the things I wanted to see. I think it came out when I was about 7.
Listen, someone says in the chat, Jason, the answer for the whole Black community. Here's the thing. I'm going to be tested on whether or not I'm a white ally based on what Jason thinks.
Yes, JB, remember that. Doug Lane is in. So you will have fun in the champagne room with these questions.
So it's not like I've come up with this idea that Jason speaks for the Black community. He came up with the idea. I'm just playing along.
Well, what I did was I surveyed the Black community, and these were the questions that they came up with, and they all told me that it was okay to ask a white person.
What do you do? Just pick up the phone? Like, it's like you have a particular Black phone?
We all get it. We got it when they... Whenever they make big changes in Black stuff, like what name are you guys going to go by this year? Your phone rings and you know how you get a notification. It's like it says Black community. And then it's just a mess.
It's a janky old rotary.
It's like African American. And then, and then it just. And then that goes away. But a serious question.
All right. I have a phone for all the Dougs. We're all connected, all the Dougs in the world. It's diverse. It's not all white people or all Black people or anything. Just all the Dougs. You don't believe me? Random.
I don't believe you.
I can.
You don't think you have a phone for all the Dougs?
I do. I have a specific phone line for that. Yeah, it's an 800 number.
Just a Black number. Everyone gets your number because you're Black on your Social Security number.
Oh, Black. Is that right?
No, that's not true. But what? Could you outline at all? Could you outline for us some of the key claims made by Grush?
Yeah, okay. Let's talk seriously. Okay, so I wrote a bunch of stuff down because you asked a lot of good questions, and we should put this in context because you know what? We've been kidding around, but I don't know. There's a possibility. Let's say there's a 5% chance that David Grush is like right. Okay, so David Grush is a former intelligence officer with the Air Force, the U.S. Space Command, and was a representative of the National Reconnaissance Office, an agency of the DOD that designs, builds, launches, and operates satellites for the military. He was also in the Unidentified Aerial Phenomena Task Force, which was dismantled in 2021 and replaced by AARO, the All-Domain Anomaly Resolution Office, and he has claimed, one, that he was informed in the course of his official duties at the Unidentified Aerial Phenomenon Task Force that there's been a multi-decade-long UFO Crash Retrieval and Reverse Engineering Program. He was denied access to the facilities involved with those, with that program. He has interviewed 40 witnesses within the intelligence community, and on that basis, he believes that the U.S. has biological matter of non-human origins that were retrieved from crashed vehicles. The vehicles are also of extraterrestrial origin and utilize advanced technology that functions on scientific principles beyond humanity's current level of understanding. He claims he's faced reprisals, threats, and other harm from officials within the U.S. government as a consequence of his fulfilling his assigned task within the UAPTF, namely the task of investigating UFOs and the government's history with these unexplained objects. He says that other witnesses to the program, craft and bodies, alien bodies, have been harmed and even killed by those wishing to conceal the information that he's now trying to uncover. He has claimed to have a list.
In your opinion, why hasn't he, sorry to interrupt you, but why hasn't he been killed? I mean, that's the first question people are going to ask.
I don't know. I mean, I guess, it seems to me that somewhere, here's my answer, actually. This is my best guess. The U.S. state is split. There are different factions within the government that, and some factions want this information to come forward. They could be just kooks and the information could be totally false. That's one explanation why he hasn't been killed. It's because he's full of it. But the other, if it's true, then it's because there's some sort of loosening. There's kind of a battle going on within the state, and he's using the tension between branches of government to step forward with this information. That would be the other
serious question, because your video essay, you know, I don't want people to think that, you know, Doug made some weird tinfoil hat video essay. It's a very serious essay. And we're going to get into the seriousness in a little bit, but kind of to the point about what the state does to repress, you know, information leaking out. At this point, do you feel that they have to repress or threaten someone at this point? Because saying some of these things, most people are just going to look at you like a loon. And once you're perceived crazy, that's just what you are.
Right. Well, okay. Again, I don't know. I want to start by restating, like, I don't know if what he's saying is true. He could be crazy, right? But look, I think the 2021 reporting in the New York Times by Leslie Keene and the testimony from the pilots who are also part of the UAP hearings has changed moved the Overton window. So I'll jump ahead. I'll go through to some other things that Grush has claimed, and I'll get back to it. But it really hasn't been the case since Project Blue Book was released from the Air Force in 1968.
You want to give us a little brief?
Project Blue Book was an Air Force report on flying saucers published in 1968. There were a lot of sightings, and there was a lot of interest around. There had been for 20 years since Kenneth Arnold had first seen something in the skies. He was a pilot, and he reported cigar-shaped craft, I think it was, skipping across the sky like saucers skipping across the surface of a lake. And that is where the term flying saucers comes from. And at least I think that's right. That may be apocryphal, but that in any case, since then, and since the Roswell incident in 1947, where a farmer and some military officials apparently found a crashed disc outside of Roswell, New Mexico, and it was reported in the local newspapers at the time and was picked up by the national press as well. And then after that, the true story or the debunking or the disinformation campaign started, depending on your point of view. And it turned out it had been a weather balloon that they retrieved and not not a crashed disc at all, according to the official story. But anyway, since 1947, there have been a lot of sightings, and the Air Force investigated, and they released a report, an official report called Project Blue Book. And in it, there were many, many reports of saucers or, you know, UFOs, unidentified craft, that they managed to explain. And then there was a subcategory. I don't remember how many, but, you know, like, let's say 10%. I'm not remembering the exact number of, you know, sightings that the Air Force could not officially explain, which meant that from that point on, the government's official stance was UFOs are real. That is, unidentified flying objects are real. There are things that have been unidentified flying through the air that cannot be explained. And I think that cannot be explained in terms of conventional physics, even. Now, that could have been due to an error in the perception of the people reporting on these craft. But nonetheless, that was the official stance of the U.S. government from 1968 forward. And then in 2021, a number of videos from pilots that they captured from their, you know, planes, from the military planes, through gun cameras and other, and also radar tracking and other ways of capturing the images of these objects, was released. And the footage itself is not that convincing, but along with the witness testimony, it seems to indicate that there were fairly miraculous events that took place where there were discs or actually one of them was a tic-tac shaped object that was flying over the ocean that moved in ways like it levitated for a while, then it took off with great speed. There was perhaps one underwater. The reporting on that was fairly convincing because it was tracked by multiple craft and sensors, and no one could explain what they saw. It didn't seem to have any source of propulsion, didn't have any heat generated by whatever it was propelling the craft. And it also was able to jam the radar of one of the jets that tried to approach it. There is something happening. What it exactly is, I don't know. It hasn't become clear, but there are the official stances that the U.S. government is investigating and has created a division within the intelligence community to investigate reports of anomalous or unidentified objects in the air. But should I go back to what he was?
Yeah.
So he said that the other witnesses to these programs have been harmed or even killed by those wishing to conceal the information. He's claimed to have a list of locations where these UFOs are stored and or where the alien bodies are stored. He offered to turn over all his documented evidence, including the list of 40 witnesses and the locations of the UFOs to Congress. He said that in the hearing, but he requested a SCIF, a secured room, so he could brief them on what was classified information. I do not believe a SCIF was provided. The Pentagon blocked the Congress from obtaining a SCIF, a secured room. That is the last I heard anyway. He's been reluctant to talk openly and give specifics about the reprisals he's faced because he has filed as a whistleblower and an investigation is still ongoing into the reprisals he's faced. And so he doesn't want to harm that investigation. He informed AOC that a great deal of white collar crime, for instance, overcharging the government in order to reallocate funds into these secret UAP programs.
That was an interesting part of what he said. And I'd love to know how you feel about that, where he said that a lot of the misappropriated funds that we've been hearing so much about, I forget how many billion or trillion actually was misappropriated No one knows where the money went. These are all quote unquote accounting errors. The conspiracy theorists, the QAnon folks, you know, maybe even people that watch this show might have watched that hearing and their ears perked up a little bit. How did you feel when you heard him say that?
Yeah, how I feel. You know what? I wasn't surprised at all. I didn't think that it necessarily would be the explanation for all the misallocated funds. Mm-hmm. I mean, I bet a lot of that goes into people's pockets. And, you know, I don't think that we're the United States government, well, at least, or the military industrial complex is necessarily all that different than, let's say, the warlords in Ukraine on that level. But it I didn't disbelieve it either. I didn't think, oh, I couldn't be, but I just thought that may not explain everything that we know is going on, but it certainly seemed plausible to me. He claims to have informed the new head of Arrow, Dr. Kirkpatrick, about his evidence. And Kirkpatrick has not, according to Grush, contacted him or followed up. Kirkpatrick, after the hearings, claimed that Grush did not contact him and issued a statement defending Arrow and decrying the disrespect that Grush had demonstrated towards his organization and the people who he works with, the disrespect that he thought was implied in Grush's testimony. So that's all the claims I have from Grush.
Well, in your video essay, you compare the U.S. UFO sightings with sightings of the Virgin Mary in Spain pre-World War II.
Right.
Can you elaborate on both of those phenomenon and why you looked so far back for Spain and you didn't do the same thing with your U.S. sightings?
Well, I mean...
maybe you want to get into the theory first of...
Yeah, I'd just say that UFO sightings and sightings of the Virgin Mary seem to break with our everyday understanding of how the world works. Mm-hmm. So, like, UFOs seem to break the laws of physics. Apparitions of the Virgin appear to indicate some non-physical reality is operating beyond the level of our understanding. Mm-hmm. So, the comparison didn't seem to be a stretch. And in the book... The Edge of Reality, which I showed earlier, I'll pull it up again. Edge of Reality. One of the ufologists, I think it was Jacques Vallée, wonders if the UFO phenomenon that we experience today might have been always a part of the human experience, and that the and that just in the past these types of events were interpreted differently. So, like stories of magical creatures like leprechauns or fairies
might derive. Monster.
Well, the Loch Ness Monster might derive from I think he was more interested in these little people, because they're like the UFO stories often include little aliens that come out, you know, right? Anyway, these stories might be coming from the same phenomenon. And that would also mean that our understanding of it today isn't necessarily 100% accurate either. It's not necessarily, he wasn't saying, oh, we've been visited by aliens from other planets all along. He was saying there's some mysterious aspect to human life that we have tried to explain in a variety of ways, and today we explain it in this way that's contemporary and modern and technological.
Robert Anton Wilson, you cite in your early on in your video essay, who quotes, there's a quote, everything we see is inside our heads. You want to explain that experiment that he gave people?
Yeah. So, you know, it's a literal fact that, you know, what we see is not outside, but it's the way our brain and eye system interprets stimulus. Right. And he says, and what that means is that a lot of the ways in which we see the world is kind of happening due to the way our brains are set up, and even how our consciousness is programmed, mm-hmm. Or is preset. And he to try to illustrate his point, he says, try the following experiment. Have a friend hold a newspaper that you haven't really looked at yet, you haven't read, and to hold it up so the front page is visible, and then have that friend walk away from you and continue holding up the paper until the headlines are out of focus. Then have them turn the page to another part of the newspaper and making sure that you can't read the headlines, and then have them read the headlines aloud to you. And the idea is that once read aloud, you'll be able to see what these headlines say that were unclear and out of focus to you before, which shows you. And it's not just that you'll know what they're, what they say, but you'll see it. And it's a demonstration of how what you see is a consequence of what you think you know, as much as it is a matter of what is actually there.
Now, you juxtapose that to Karl Marx in his writings in the German ideology.
Right. So what Karl Marx says is that he's kind of explaining ideology, and he says that the ideology is not like it's not just a matter of a friend reading the headline aloud and then you seeing it, but also it's a matter of living in a historical moment where the way in which we organize our productive activity and the way in which we live includes the production of newspapers. Mm-hmm. There's a historical life process that is informing our understanding as much as our understanding is informing how we live in history. So, and it is no less significant and no less a part of life than our eye brain system is, so that it is a material fact that's shaping us. The history of how we've related to each other and produced and reproduced the world has created material consequences which inform our understanding or the kinds of ideologies that we pick up and use to live. Mm-hmm. So that means that we're, you know, in a very large way shaped by our history, and our understanding of the world and who we are is shaped by that history as well.
And we understand ourselves as the center of the universe. So, of course, we're going to see aliens. Is that what you're saying?
Well, actually, I don't know. I mean, aliens are from... Do we still see ourselves as the center of the universe? I mean, yeah. We technically don't, right? I mean, technically, we know the Earth revolves around the sun, and we're just revolving around one sun on the edge of a spiral arm of the Milky Way, and the universe is bigger than we can fathom, and it started with an explosion, you know, the Big Bang. And so I don't know. Do we think, and if we think, oh, well, these are flying saucers from another part of the universe, does that mean that we're putting ourselves at the center, or are we accepting ourselves as just one planet amongst many?
Don't you have to be at the center to assume that they want to come here?
I don't know. Have you seen First Contact, the Star Trek movie?
No, I did not watch any of the Star Trek prequels or whatever you'd call them. J.J. Abrams Star Treks.
No. It's this is the one with, you know, it's the new generation, Patrick Stewart and all that.
Oh, okay. That's what you're talking about. What's the name of the J.J. Abrams one called?
Oh, I don't know. The first one's just called Star Trek, and then there's like, we're trying to do Wrath of Khan again, and then there's, I don't know, something else. But there's one where the Vulcans come to Earth, and they come because the humans have developed warp drive and shot a ship out into space and back, and they have sensors that detect this, and they come to see what's going on the planet. So, you know, it's conceivable that there might be life close by enough, especially if our understanding of physics is wrong and something like warp drive is possible, which I have no reason to claim that's anything more than a fancy, but nonetheless, I don't think that we'd have to be narcissistically self-obsessed to think that a universe teeming with life would also bring different life forms, you know, would include us being visited.
Well, you know, in your essay, you argue that UFO conspiracies don't really tell us a lot about aliens, but rather about how we perceive the world, which is, I guess, what we're getting in right now.
Yeah, right.
Especially the power of the U.S. state. And that's what I really dug about what you were when you're doing. Can you explain that theory to us about how this tells us more about how we view the state as kind of the all-powerful when we talk about UFOs and what we're allowed to know about them?
Yeah, I mean, this is why I referred to Close Encounters so much in that video. So if we accept that our understanding of the world is at least partially subjective, and that is that it arises from the history of our efforts to both understand the world and work out a way to live in it together, you know, in this Marxist way, then we can understand that the way the government plays a role in our contemporary understanding of UFOs or aliens also just demonstrates the centrality of state power overall. Mm-hmm. Like our primary way of understanding and relating to the world is, you know, kind of behind our backs, or it seems like so natural we don't notice, but it's defined by state power and big capital, big corporate state power. And that is in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. That is a story of a relatively benign government conspiracy. Mm-hmm. So I think that it's worth noting. And it also, you know, we're living after World War II. We're living after the managerial state has become especially dominant in our lives. Mm-hmm. That's something that we should remember as we ask ourselves, you know, what would it mean if these UFOs were real? And one of the things it would mean if Grush's claims are true is that, you know, the state, this managerial state, has been blocking the rest of us from fully understanding our place in the universe for, according to Grush, like a century.
Would that mean though, Doug? And we have a super chat, and I do want to get to this before I ask this question. Yeah. How will societies react if aliens were confirmed? Have you ever seen Alien Nation?
I don't think I have seen Alien Nation. Is that a TV series or a movie?
It was both. But I guess the bigger thing for me is I understand what you're saying, but wouldn't that also involve a global cover-up at that point? 100 years we're talking, and you're saying all these nations that are warring with each other, it's all that at that point would just be kayfabe, and they're all in cahoots to protect the grand secret then, and the grand secret is, you know, there's aliens like the movie The Thing living in Antarctica, 3 miles deep in the Earth's core. Is that what we're saying here with this?
Well, there have been different moments in other nations where more or less information has been reported. I think the amount of acceptance that at least the UFO phenomenon, that is that there are unidentified things out in the skies, are more or less accepted. I would say that going back to The Edge of Reality and J. Allen Hynek and Jacques Vallée, just rereading it, they say, well, one thing we can know is that they're not here to invade the Earth and try to take us over. So the way in which the phenomenon seems to have played out is rather mysterious and distant and nuanced. And, Grush hasn't said the United States government has a treaty with the aliens and is selling our body parts. He said there are crashed discs and we have them, you know, in bunkers. And there are some alien bodies stored away, and we're trying to reverse engineer and have been trying to reverse engineer the technology from these craft for a long, long time. That's what he said. And that they continue to be seen as well, these unidentified flying objects. So if what he's saying is true, then, you know, I don't know what it would, how it would serve any given state to reveal that they have their own crashed discs. Or, I mean, one thing I did think is perhaps we're saying, oh yeah, we have these alien forms of technology that we've been reverse engineering them for a long time, and we want everyone to kind of know that we have this stuff. Mm-hmm. As a way to say to the Chinese, perhaps, yeah, it looks like we're desperate, like we're using cluster bombs in Ukraine now, and we're sort of out of ammunition, but we got, you know, the secret stuff that no one even knows about.
It's one of those things where it's like, okay, you're saying you have all this grand technology, but we have this plane called the F-35 that we've sunk in, you know, untold fortunes into, and it's just, it doesn't work. So are the aliens sitting there going,
if you give us $1 billion, we will tell you the secrets of a magical plane that will destroy your enemies and they will never see you coming. And, you know, is this what we're saying here, that the aliens are effing with us? Like,
yeah, it turns out. Yes, Jason.
Like a Mr. Show.
That is what the aliens are saying. And, you know, what's weird is they're using that exact voice.
A gabillion's not a number to these people, sir. But, well, a million trillion. Then
whatever is a large number,
they want it in U.S. dollars. I don't know why, but they want it in U.S. dollars. No, I don't. Yeah, like, really, I don't know. We can, like, I don't think we can say much about the actual aliens or whatever these supposed creatures are, if they exist. If what Grush is saying is true, I don't think that what Grush's story is tells us very much or clarifies the mystery of what's behind the UFO experience, except that there are apparently creatures involved that we've seen and that we have some of their bodies. But other than that, he hasn't said anything publicly anyway that indicates that there's a lot of deep knowledge of extraterrestrials. He's not even willing to commit that from what he's heard, that these are creatures from another star, right? He is not committed to explaining what they are. He says it could be extra-dimensional beings. It could be something else. I have no way of knowing. They're just not of earthly origin. So if what Grush is saying is true, and I'm not saying that it is, but if it is, he's not telling us a lot, really, about the aliens. He's telling us a lot more about the state and about the disinformation campaign, he says, that the state has been running on the American public. And I think it should be taken up as a way of informing ourselves as individuals and kind of as a civil society, mm-hmm. as the people who should be in charge of the state, how far away we are from actually having collective power currently. And how we have lost kind of control of our own society. And it's not like the state has control either, exactly. It just is the most powerful player around. But it's not like things are going to their design. It's just that, you know, they're constantly trying to cope with keeping the ball rolling.
Is this a way for the national security sector to spend some more money, possibly? Like,
oh, sure.
Well, yeah. There's aliens out there, so we have to get a Death Star gun. We got to build
like
a Death Star.
They could have done that a lot more easily than this. I don't really know what's behind it, but if it's not true, given my state of mind lately, if it's not true, though, I think the whole purpose of it is just to play with the public and get everyone to accept that they can be told wild lies and then never have the truth come out. Like, just be told these tall tales, have it run through the media, and then have it go away. It's like just a test of, like, what can we get away with these suckers? Is how I feel that it is. But But the more optimistic part of me wants to say, well, maybe there's something to this. And
well, maybe the aliens are the ones telling the wild lies. Again, the aliens are the ones that keep lying to the U.S. government about,
no, Afghanistan is where you should be. Sink another trillion, you'll see the answers are there.
According to, if what Grush is saying is true, then that, I don't think it's fair to blame the aliens for any of this shit. They're just out there cruising around in their little Tic Tacs and crashing every once in a while. They don't seem to be in charge of anything.
What if aliens created TikTok?
Tic Tac. They're Tic Tac. I know,
but what if they created TikTok?
And it's it was the Chinese.
What if it's a Chinese lie and it's actually aliens?
That would explain a lot. Have you watched TikTok?
Only when one of the younger members of the TIR family sends a video over, because we are all old and none of us have TikTok.
I haven't. I have it on my phone.
You need to stop. You I've having been, TikTok.
I not only have I jeans. Haven't watched TikTok, but I've also released videos on TikTok. And for a while I thought, after I got canceled from Twitter, suspended, kicked off, booted, that I might try to just become a TikTok star. But so far, I have not had the stamina to produce a TikTok every day or anything.
Are you trying to do TikTok or porn? What are you talking about here?
TikTok. I don't know. I'm not so deluded to think that I could become a porn star. TikTok.
I think there's Doug Lane's OnlyFans. There's people out here waiting for the Doug Lane OnlyFans. They want to know what you look like in those britches.
I've lost a couple pounds.
I can see physically that you've lost a couple pounds. But that's an off-air conversation. In your video essay.
I'll do it. I'm going to be on OnlyFans next, folks. That's what I'm saying. All UFO content all the time on Doug's OnlyFans.
But he'll be doing naked jumping jacks while he tells you about UFOs.
You know what bothers me about that? The reason I'm reluctant? It's not the naked part.
Mm-hmm.
It's the jumping jacks part.
It's the jumping jack part.
I just get winded. Okay, all right.
If there's anyone still watching. In your video essay, you draw on the work of Max Horkheimer.
Horkheimer.
Mm-hmm. That's what I said. And the rise of UFO sightings to the transformation of reason. Mm-hmm. What did you mean by this?
All right, I have it written down right here. I brought in Horkheimer not to merely illustrate that our reason has been transformed historically, but to point out the specific way that it's been transformed. I actually really, I've been reading and rereading The Eclipse of Reason by Horkheimer, and because I'm bitter, and it reflects my bitter attitude really well. But he says that what was reason through the process of capital's development has become unreason. So during the Enlightenment, the position was that we could rely on our own individual reason, a reason that was publicly and universally available, in order to understand and make our way through the world as free people. Instead, today, reason is mediated through state and corporate power. So rather than thinking about our own individual needs or the needs of ourselves and our community, we first consider the needs of the state and of capitalism, if only unconsciously. And that means our reason is mediated by concentrated capital. And basically what we reason about, what we think through, is when and where and how to submit to authority. And it's these forms of state authorities and corporate and capitalist authority that we identify with as representing, guaranteeing, and even defining ourselves and our life and our needs for us.
Well, then.
Bummer, huh?
So is that really the motivation? So everything you said earlier is BS, and the real motivation was just kind of your your bitter frustration and all this as a way for you to, you know, thumb your nose at the world?
You know what? I am bitter and I am frustrated, but I'm bitter and frustrated about things I think are true. And what makes me want to thumb my nose at, let's be honest, a good portion of the people who call themselves the left right now, is not my own personal bitterness. I mean, you know, I don't know. Maybe a shrink would say there's other reasons than just my reaction to what I see is true in the news. But it does seem to me that we're in a moment where I'm going to talk about Trump for a second. Like the fact that our choice right now is between an administration that has decided to try to imprison the major oppositional candidate from the other party with these indictments, which seem to me, and I think seem to at least half the American population, to be completely politically motivated, or to choose to back that administration, which is what most of the left is doing, or back this blowhard, narcissistic reality TV, quasi would be not quite fascist, is pretty fucking depressing, and it's a disaster that's unfolding before us. And while that disaster is going on, we're in a society which has decided not to allow free expression anymore, to clamp down on all the major media. So in that context, it's this UFO story, I guess we should greet it with the extra bit of skepticism because it's making its way through. But you know, I nonetheless find it hopeful that this story is out there and I like playing around with the idea that it might be true, but I don't have any justified reasons to think it is true at the moment.
You haven't become a Posadist is what you're saying.
Oh, well, I wish I could be a Posadist.
I mean, hey, this question is from Mean Gene Bajlan. You mentioned Jay Posadas, a Trotskyist who saw aliens as a potential ally in the fight for socialism. What do you think this tells us about, as he says, the crisis on the left?
Okay, I wrote down a response to this. I think today's left laughs at Posadas when they ought to be jealous of him. Yeah, because the reason they laugh is they presume that the UFO phenomenon is not real, right? But but the unknown, the mysterious, the world beyond the present set of powers has become a joke. I mean, in other words, the UFO represents this, for Posadas, really is a kind of a version of the power of human reason and scientific development and independent and self-responsible humanity projected onto the stars. The UFO represented the utopian dimension of his own socialism. And so maybe he was regressed below earlier utopian socialists like Fourier, who believed that utopia would be arrived at through the development of our human reason directly, and thought that the future of humanity would be as fantastic and magical as what we imagined the UFO societies might be like. But nonetheless, he still believed that there was a relationship with the world that could be had, that could transform the world. And his desire for these UFO people to assist the Fourth International in transforming society was actually less authoritarian and more forward-looking than most of our current cynicism, wherein we think about political change only in terms of begging the state to let us survive. That's what I wrote down. What do you think of that?
Are we begging the state to let us survive? I mean, honestly, how did we get along before these platforms that so many people complain about or wanting to nationalize? I mean, we were still able to get the word out, quote unquote, before the internet. I was talking with, I can't remember who I was talking with earlier today. Maybe it was Pascal or Toussaint. And I was like, you know, before the internet, bands still toured. The internet makes it a little bit easier, but you know, that connectivity, that ability to promote is still kind of pales in comparison to doing things in person. So even when we do these shows, we talk about actually meeting in real life and being in meet spaces, because it really does become two different worlds. So I guess my bigger question is, where is the repression outside of private spaces?
From a socialist perspective, the fact that most of us have to sell our labor power to survive is the contradiction in society that should drive us towards socialism and towards changing the foundation of society. On the level of on the level of the media personality, let's say, the repression now has been more direct, although that's unevenly felt, but there's been an apparatus developed to censor people's speech online and in the major media. And they're working on being able to just decide what companies or publishing outfits or, record labels will be allowed and what won't be. The Restrict Act would give them the power to say, oh yeah, that punk band's record label.
But that's the way it's always been.
But well, they couldn't just directly say, we're shutting you down for your speech.
There's a lot of people that would totally disagree with you that would show proof, especially after 9/11. There's albums that didn't even come out because they had provocative covers. I mean, ask Boots Riley.
Right. Well, I'm sure that there were records that the corporate world or whoever it was that was, or the record company,
I mean, ask
or the record stores.
Ask Ice-T about a song like Cop Killer that gave him FBI file for a few years. I mean, that's
what was his record label?
He was on a major. I don't remember.
Right.
Columbia.
Did it get shut down? Because the thing is what they're. That's what I'm talking about. It's like they're going to say the U.S. Uh-huh. state has the power to just shut down uh-huh. labels that whole companies that are putting out content they don't like, or mm-hmm. enforce conformity with their edicts on what should be published and what shouldn't be. So it in the past, yeah, there was. I remember Jello Biafra and others talking about the labels that they're putting on albums, which was a form of censorship. And I know that there were record burnings and there was a lot of controversies and people's albums weren't put out because of perceived controversies.
So let me stop you right here. Where do you think it's worse than the US or the Soviet Union in the 80s? Where punk music was literally illegal.
I think it was better in the U.S. in the 80s, and I think it's better for punk musicians.
I'm talking about now. Is the U.S. now worse than
the Soviet Union? I'm saying it would still be better for the punk bands today than it would have been in the Soviet Union, when it was illegal. But what I'm saying is that where it's going to start is not with punk bands, but with places like Parler or other news outlets that will be shut down first for the political speech. So it's going to actually start where it should never reach, mm-hmm. which is protected political speech. But I would imagine that if we something like the Restrict Act passes and there's no.
Oh, we're talking about private entities here, though. We're still not talking about public spaces. We're talking about trying to have.
We're talking about the state shutting down mm-hmm. private entities mm-hmm. from expressing themselves.
Sure. But we're not talking about, basically, when I think of repression and free speech, and when I think of living in a market economy like we do, those two things I don't think work the same way that you are kind of explaining them to work. Because people follow where the money is. And if talking about aliens is where the money is, everyone's going to talk about aliens. We were joking about this before. Mm-hmm. Anna Kasparian is an industry in the little bitty world that we live in. And if we right. change this title to UFOs and Doug Lane and Jason shit on Anna for an hour, the views would be up. The super chats would be up. Everything would be up. Mm-hmm. The state doesn't have to influence that.
Well, it doesn't have to, but there have been stories that might have had a lot of organic reach, which the state has gone out of its way to suppress within the last couple of years. And what we're talking about is giving the state the power to decide regardless of what the market wants. You can't get to market if your license has been taken away and you can't open a bank account and you can't, and the corporations that are, you know, working basically, they are at this point extensions of the state, won't give you a platform. So, so what we're talking about is limiting the ability of private entities to start up and try to take their wares to the market.
Does a state have the responsibility to its citizens to protect them from certain speech?
No. Really? No, not unless it was not unless you're talking about criminal speech.
What's criminal speech?
That would be like a direct threat or an act of fraud. So like if you're standing outside of someone's house, like Elon Musk's house, and you have a bunch of people with torches behind you and you say, go burn down that guy's house, that's illegal speech. But if I say, I think all the billionaires' houses should be burned to the ground.
Well, I mean, what if people just want to say, I think, you know, just eugenic nonsense about the defectiveness of Black people, and this is why crime in Black neighborhoods are worse. And even though the Jewish community in places like New York take up most of the public housing, when you go to Black public housing, it's worse and it's crime written, ergo, they're all just defective. And what if this just became front page stories all over the place? That's fine. That's great. There should be no sort of checks and balances on that.
The state should not be allowed to criminalize speech that's protected by the First Amendment. If there, I don't think that hate speech is a thing that should be stopped by the state. And I wouldn't trust the state to determine what constitutes hate speech and what doesn't. And I'll give you an example of why I wouldn't, just a concrete example. During the outbreak of the COVID pandemic, the state pushed the idea that if you said the virus leaked from a lab in Wuhan, you were being racist. But what wasn't racist was to say that a bunch of ignorant Chinese people eating bats was the source of the virus. So the state has its own interests. And the last thing the state actually cares about is the welfare of its population, and most of all, the welfare of the most disenfranchised aspects of the population. So I think that you grant the state the power to censor speech. You're just granting the state the power to shut you down and stop your efforts to organize for a different society. You're not going to be. I mean, and the other thing is, like, during the Weimar Republic, when the Nazis were rising up, there were plenty of anti-hate speech laws. Hitler was barred from speaking for a time. They shut down Nazi newspapers, and it did not stop the rise of the Nazis. It was used as a way to perpetuate the Nazi cause by making martyrs out of the Nazis. And because the state, which was supposed to be a Republican state, meaning that people were meant to be free and have free expression, was violating its own rules and its own justification for existing, which was to provide.
I mean, we were talking about the state and repressing free speech. I mean, I don't hear you really talking about the repression of speech in places like an Amazon warehouse or McDonald's workers. I mean, this is really where speech.
Don't you? I mean, one of the first times that I talked to you, I was talking. We talked about the Amazon warehouse workers and the way they were organizing to strike, and the way I opposed the attacks that were on, you know, that perpetuated against workers. Workers absolutely should have the right to free speech and to organize politically and to try to form unions.
And you think there should be no hate speech laws whatsoever?
Yeah, I think there should be no hate speech laws whatsoever.
More hate speech the better, because there's really no hate speech that you could ever get. Like, what speech could there be at you that you would actually be like, oh wow, that's kind of frightening?
I would be frightened by someone who made a threat. I would be frightened by someone who made a threat against me and demonstrated in the way they made the threat that they could follow through.
Interesting. That's it.
Yeah. I might be made uncomfortable and uneasy by someone telling me, you know, you look like a pig and I think you should be hung from a tree or something like that. But if I don't think that there's going to be follow through, I wouldn't be hurt by the speech itself. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that the so-called progressive state is going to be an instrument for radical change. I just don't. It hasn't. I mean, look, it's bringing us to the edge of a nuclear war. It's bringing us all sorts of economic insecurity.
That's been said for the last 40 years.
It really hasn't been.
Yeah,
it really hasn't been.
You and I.
No, since not now. No, so the last 40 years would include everything past the collapse of the Soviet Union. Yeah. Actually, after that happened, there was this idea of a peace dividend. We were going to start to disarm. The threat of nuclear Armageddon started to diminish. We were entering the end of history in a new era of peace. Mm-hmm. And the threat of nuclear Armageddon being a living threat, it's just a couple of years old now. And, you know, this is Biden's own words saying we're closer to nuclear war than we have been since the Cuban Missile Crisis. That's not me saying that. That's the president of the United States.
I thought you don't trust the president.
I don't trust the president to keep us out of harm's way. I think that when he says shit like that, I believe him.
Why?
Because I can see that we're escalating a war in Ukraine that has the potential to go off the rails, and we're escalating a war in Ukraine with a nuclear power.
So you think that he's saying that because he cares about the citizens and he cares about you and he wants you to be safe and get a bunker?
No, I don't. What was the context of him saying that? I mean, I don't think that he's trying to inform. Like, if he cared about keeping us from nuclear Armageddon, he would, if he really believed it fully and felt it, I guess he would do something to set up a peaceful negotiations for the end of the escalation of the crisis. But I do think that he spoke relatively honestly when he said that we're closer to nuclear war than we have been since the Cuban Missile Crisis.
So you don't think that has anything to do with, you know, an election year and wanting to be the savior of the people?
No, it wasn't an election year. And I hasn't
coming up on an election year.
Yeah, but he didn't. He said it like a year ago.
Okay. And he hasn't said it since.
No, he hasn't said it again and again and again, as far as I know.
I'm playing devil's advocate with you.
But it sounds like you. I think the controversial thing I said was I don't think there should be hate speech laws.
Sure.
Right.
I mean, not that
the war in Ukraine should.
We just have to be honest about, you know, people's relation to certain speech, right?
Sure.
And that is going to color the way you see free speech and the like.
Yeah, but I don't think I think there are many people who have been on the receiving end of, let's say, racial epithets who are nonetheless committed to the First Amendment and who understand the necessity to protect free speech. I don't think it's I can see why, people.
I didn't say anything. I'm asking questions.
Yeah, but that seemed to imply.
You can imply all you want. I didn't say
anything. No, you implied. I inferred. And you did imply that because I was white, I would be less concerned about racial epithets than.
I mean, it could be because you live in Portland.
Could. Yeah, I guess so.
I'm not terrified in Portland.
Are you terrified where you are now?
No, I feel so much safer here than I did in the U.S. And I live down this. Well, I will keep my mouth shut so I can stay alive. But, you know, I live near quote unquote trouble and it so much safer here than in the U.S.
That's good.
You know, it's different for me driving up to your house than it is for you riding around in that same area.
Well, I just live in a very safe neighborhood in Portland. It's not ritzy or anything, but it's this sort of working class, but nonetheless, mostly safe neighborhood. I don't remember the last time there was a shooting here.
Yeah, I can say the same.
But I don't think that shootings are brought on by the lax laws, you know, the lack of laws banning speech.
I mean, well, let's for example, there is no surveillance that we really want to believe is there, because the kid in Santa Barbara that shot up that, I think it was a coffee shop he shot up, he had been leaving video messages for some time that no one watched about what he was going to do, and no one cared.
Right. And if they had found those video messages and taken them seriously,
would you have wanted that kid arrested?
Yeah. If he was declaring his intention to come and attack those people.
How do you know he's serious?
Well, you that is illegal, to directly threaten someone with violence. That is a violation of people's rights. I mean, that you're not allowed to send people direct death threats. Mm-hmm. That's a direct threat. So yeah, of course he should have been investigated.
Shut down for a week, which actually was quite costly for this show, for hate speech. It was myself and Robbie Martin. So if you might know Robbie, he's Abby's brother, actually Abby's older brother. Mm-hmm. We did a show in studio and we just talked about QAnon. We didn't say F those guys. If they were in front of us right now, we'd beat the shit out of them. None of that was ever said, because that wasn't even part of the conversation. And that's not how we talk. Mm-hmm. But yet and still, it was hate speech. Enough for them to shut us down. And that's been happening to quite a few shows.
Well, I mean, online, because of these companies have their own content policies. Mm-hmm. Of course, there are rules around hate speech. And the degree to which those rules are set up by the state, they're unconstitutional. But I wouldn't begrudge someone deciding to moderate their content so that kind of shit doesn't go on their website. Like, I wouldn't allow it on my own YouTube channel to stand, even if it was well within the let's talk about why I got canceled from Twitter. You tell me if you think I should have been. Have you know why I got canceled? Or
you made a dumbass joke,
right? Do you think that it constituted hate speech or was a violent,
you know, my brother got suspended for making a very similar joke from high school.
What did he say?
He said he wished he could kill all his classmates with telepathy.
I think I could have gotten away with that. Not with killing people. Well, I think I could have gotten away with actually killing people with telepathy, because who would know, right? How could you figure that out? But also, I think I could have gotten away with saying that on Twitter. What I said was RFK Jr. should be shot. Yeah. But I said it sarcastically to someone who was saying he shouldn't be allowed to speak. And I was like, why is this even allowed? This guy should be shot. Mm-hmm. Meaning the exact opposite of what I said. But so that was violent speech according to Twitter's rules and regulations. I don't believe that it was constitutionally unprotected speech, but that would have been adjudicated to be a direct threat, certainly not given the context of it. But I literally meant the opposite of what I was saying. But in any case, we've gotten off topic.
You shouldn't threaten people running for office, first and foremost.
I
been in the house with you, you probably would have yelled out, Jason, I'm going to totally send this tweet. And I would have been like, Doug.
I wouldn't have. I had had the wherewithal to ask you about it, I wouldn't have done it anyway.
Then we would have walked to one of the 47 strip clubs that are within walking distance of your front door, and we would have had a steak.
You know what? I don't live that close to strip clubs.
There's like 1,000.
Yeah, but not, I mean, how far do you think I want to walk?
<It's>,
So in any case, yeah. So are we going to the champagne room?
We're going to the champagne room.
All right.
We will be playing.
You can let me have it some more over my white privilege in the champagne room. And I believe it will be on full display. But I have Google open, and I have also my answer. Like anytime when I was a kid, I had a friend who would constantly ask his father Star Wars trivia questions.
Mm-hmm.
And his answer, whenever he didn't know the answer, was always Billy Dee Williams. So that is going to be my answer whenever I don't know the answer today.
Is Billy Dee Williams?
Billy Dee Williams.
I am so excited for this because, like, literally, Toussaint and I sat down and thought of all the things that we could say that would just make you crack the fuck up.
All right. I can't wait for that. And then around 8, I got to run. But let's go.
Yeah. We'll be brief. Hey, yeah. Doug, thank you so much. Everywhere you guys are watching or listening to the show, there's going to be links in the description to Doug's video essay. I forget the title of it.
It's called Critical Cuts. What if UFOs are real? Or so what will UFO? I kept changing the title to try to get more clicks. what will UFO disclosure reveal? I think it's what it's called. That was what it was called.
Okay. Well, it doesn't matter because we put a link up right to the video.
Right. Great.
Do you know what changed the title to UFOs and Anna Kasparian and see what happens?
Yeah. It's like Anna Kasparian. And after that, you should go and buy a copy of my book, which was, I think, published in 2015.
Is it available? Like, will you get any royalties if anyone buys it?
Yeah, I know. I still get royalty checks. Let me tell you one brief story and then we can.
Yes.
I got a royalty check for this book. Or either that or Batch Best Revolution or both, because it was the same publisher. Mm-hmm. And it was for like $98. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, cool. And I put it in my back pocket. And then I ran my jeans through the washer. And I'm like trying to spread it out on top of the dryer. And I'm like, oh, it doesn't matter because I can just take a picture and have them deposit it. And like, that shit, we don't know what that is. Picture.
Well, Doug, that's why when you are an ASCAP member like myself, you just get direct deposit.
Oh, yeah. All right.
I stopped putting down my shit. All right. Hey, Doug, you have the link to the champagne room.
We're going send it to right me again. Yeah.
Okay. I'll send it to you Facebook.
Is that good? Yeah.
Okay. Yep. Thank you guys for watching. It's always a fun conversation hanging out with Doug Lane. I always have to say this every time you're on because I want to remind people why you are an important person to me is because you helped grow this show exponentially by letting us do a weekly program on Zero Books. So always have so much love and respect for everything you do. You are an influence on what I do, even with this new feature film that I'm putting out. So thank you for all the work that you do. You know, even if you guys don't agree with him, he still makes some compelling arguments. So on that note, we are out.